Hello there, and welcome to our podcast, Conversations in Noosa. My name is John Caruso. Brendan Neal is a dad of two boys who prefers to lead by example rather than simply dictate. He recently completed 10 consecutive days, 2 kilometres offshore, swimming more than 110 kilometres, all for charity. Make yourself a cuppa, pour a glass of wine or crack a beer, and enjoy being a fly on the wall as we talk Buddhist minimalism, raising boys, growing up in Papua New Guinea, and pushing yourself out of your comfort zone.
Every year, there's a group of people who get out and they swim for the Kurrumundi and Nambour Special Schools here on the Sunshine Coast. And they start off at Majimba Beach, swim around Old Woman Island, and head all the way down to Mooloolaba. So that's about 11 Ks on the wrong side of the shark nets. This year would have been my 10th year of doing that swim, but I was out of action in hospital and missed out on it. I had an operation and a bit of miscommunication between myself and the surgeon. He said, you won't want to do much for a week. So I thought, okay, take a week off work. It was in school holidays. So I got two boys. So still took them down the beach every day, walked the dog, did all this stuff. Went back to work on Monday and then, things didn't go so well. So I ended up back seeing him and straight into hospital. So that was just before the swim. So anyway, sitting in there, that was over Anzac Day, I remember, and I said, you know what, I feel like doing something a bit more exciting. It would have been my 10th year of the swim. So how about I have a dig at just trying to do it 10 times in 10 days?
Had you swum every year or had you missed some years, Brent?
No, every year.
So okay.
9 years straight, that 10th year this year, missed out. So I was feeling a bit lost and because it's an awesome community. It's not a race at all. It's just something you do for the schools themselves. It's all about the schools, the kids, helping those families and everything. And primarily the people who get involved in that year after year are just the sort of people who are just the best people on the Sunshine Coast. So I think opportunities like that just bring out what we really love about our community. And it's just something that I really missed not being a part of this year.
So tell me about the preparation going into to looking down the barrel at going, okay, I'm going to do that swim every day. And then the course, the same course, so down to it's 11 Ks.
That's right, yeah. Well, it's somewhere in between 10 and 11 Ks, depending how straight you can keep it. There's no lanes out there. So you're out in the water. You're sort of about 2.5 kilometres offshore for a lot of the way.
Yeah.
And you pretty much are at the mercy of the conditions. So preparation-wise, I've made a pretty good habit over that 10 years of turning up completely fresh, completely untrained. A few years I've been really fit for it.
Yeah.
And this year, I hadn't done any swimming as such. And so just prior to August, I squeezed in 16 swims. So 11 of those were in the ocean and 5 were in a pool.
Yeah.
So that was the sum of my swimming training.
Okay. What kind of support crew do you have out there? Do you have someone that comes alongside you in a boat or some kind of vessel or something?
Absolutely. So every year you have someone next to you when you do that swim. And so I had a friend on a jet ski. And he every morning, we jump up, load the jet ski off at the ramp down at Mooloolaba, paddle the way up to Majimba. I jump out, swim to the beach. Mum and Dad were usually there, and a few friends. So I give him a hug and a kiss, turn around, and off I go.
Yeah,
yeah. So I'm pretty fortunate. Yeah, I've got a jet ski next to me the whole way, just keeping me in a straight line, and just making sure that if something bad were to happen, he could either pick up the pieces or drag me back to shore.
Do you remember your times for each day? And what do you recall about the time that it took you? Did it progressively get longer and longer, or did your time get better and better as you were?
Yeah, it varied greatly.
And depending on conditions.
All condition-wise. Yeah, sure. So, look, the first day I got out there, and depending on the tide, always when you swim out to the island, it's about 1.8 kilometres to the back of the island, and it was on an incoming tide. So, it's going to be pretty hard swimming up around the island itself, and it's a bit bumpy, but we turn the island and head south, and I've never experienced that current out in the ocean before over the 10 years of swimming out there. And we were swimming for close to an hour or so, and Troy, the safety guy on the jet ski, it sort of told me to stop and look back, and I looked back, and the island was like, 500 meters away, and I'd been going for over an hour. That current was just insane. Wow. So I just had to put my head down and keep going. And I can tell you, on that first day, that was so humbling. And I was like, Brennan, what have you done?
Well, the experience, the conditions that you just described, was that day one, was it?
That was day one.
Okay. Yeah. So when you woke up for day two, what was going through your mind?
Dig deep, get in there.
I've got nine more of these to do.
Yeah, pretty much. But look, I scored fantastic conditions most of the time. There were 3 days that were pretty bad. Day nine was the second last day. It was a horrendous day as well. It was so rough and rugged. But I was actually looking forward to that. By then, I felt really strong, felt great. And I sort of wanted that experience of getting into, I don't know, a really difficult and challenging space, I guess, and trying to bust out of that. And I got that on day nine. It was horrendous.
Yeah. But tell me about that. You hear that with marathon runners who get to a certain level where it's I'm going to die, I'm going to die, I'm going to die. And then I'm going to push through this barrier. And then it's like, the endorphins set in, or maybe they've set in before that, better than me. But what happens at that moment in your brain, and what's your brain telling your body, and what's your body telling your brain, and what are you telling yourself in terms of to keep going?
Yeah, look, the good thing with doing that swim for the schools is you get to know a lot of families and kids and the school community. So it doesn't take much to think of someone else and think of the daily struggles they go through or whatever is happening. So we'd get up in the morning and I'd know that I'm kicking off from the beach at around 7 o'clock in the morning. And at the same time, there's a couple of hundred families on the coast that have got these kids going to these schools that are facing challenges that I've never had to face. I will never have to face at all as a parent. And, those sorts of things, you just go, hey, it's nothing much. I've got somewhere between, depending on the conditions, between 3 or 4.5 hours today out in the water. And, that's it. I get out at the other end. I can have something to eat and drink and have a nice bath or something.
Thoughts like that put everything into perspective, doesn't it?
Completely.
Because then you think, well, there are kids that you're describing, who live with the kind of challenges 24/7. You mentioned at the start, Brendan, that you're on the wrong side of the shark fence for a lot of, or the shark net for a lot of that time. Did you have any hairy moments?
The mind is a really funny thing. And, when we swim around the island, and sometimes we'll just swim around for fun because it is a really nice swim on the right conditions. And, a few friends and I will do that sometimes throughout the year or something. And you always see turtles. You see some wobbegongs. You see fish. You see all these, stingrays, manta rays. And occasionally you might see something else, but it's usually fairly tame. And I guess for myself, swimming over those 10 days, there was just one day that was for no reason at all. I stopped a couple of times and said to Troy on the jet ski, I said, mate, I just feel like I'm almost holding your hand. I was swimming really close to the jet ski, and every sort of 10 minutes, he would have to sort of floor the jet ski and do a big circle because the nature of those engines, you don't want them just idling the whole time. So when he'd do that, he'd be gone for 30 seconds or so. And on this particular day, and normally you just keep swimming, you're out in the middle of the ocean, you just keep swimming. And on this particular day, I'd be swimming just going, okay, cool your head, he'll be back soon. And it was just, I don't know what it was. It was a bit of a dark day and a bit funny. And yeah. I just felt like there were things around.
Conditions were murky.
Yeah. Coincidentally, the next morning was when that a small whale washed up on Alex Beach that had a few chomp marks taken out of it. And yeah, right. I had quite a few people, actually heaps of people, sending me the photo and pointing out those chomp marks. But
Brendan, one of the reasons I did want to get you in to talk about the swim was because I was telling my wife, Deb, about the bloke that spent 157 days swimming around the UK. Have I got the stats right?
Yeah.
And then what happened to him? And and Deb was like, oh, that's just crazy, she said. Why do people do that? And there was an explanation in the article. He was encouraging people to push themselves out of their comfort zone. Mm. And Deb said, at least do something for a good cause, like Brendan. And I thought, well, that's interesting. And I know you shared that article as well about the guy that's wondering. What were your thoughts when you read something like that? Someone that pushes themselves to that point. Because I can't remember all the conditions, but he had bits of his tongue were falling off, and he got some rot on his feet, and he called it rhino neck from the wetsuit.
Absolutely.
Did you wear a wetsuit, by the way, for the whole?
Yeah, I did. So a sleeveless wetsuit, but a good wetsuit, Thought he was crazy as well. that's a big effort. And, you know, he was out in the water 8 hours a day, sometimes longer.
For 157 days.
Yeah. And it's a long time. It's a long time. But clearly people who go and swim the English Channel and do all these amazing things, ultra runners and that. And I think, look, one of the things that I got out of it, John, was that you can be amazed, or you would be amazed at how much you're actually capable of, or how much more you're capable of than you realize. And I think everyone is. And it's not so much about trying to be the greatest at something, but for myself, it's just try something so you're a little bit better than what you were yesterday. And, you know, a lot of other people, part of me doing that swim as well was I really wanted to reach out and meet new people and get new people aware of that charity swim every year, and so that they can put a team in or do it themselves next year in May. And a lot of people were keen, and that's what I found. And then a lot of people sort of said, well, I could never do that. And I'm like, well, you don't have to jump out and do it 10 times or anything. You can just start swimming, get a couple of friends together, and you'd be amazed at how much more you can do than what you realize.
For you, when it comes to pushing yourself and challenging yourself, and then obviously you dovetail that into supporting a worthwhile charity as well, where does that come from? Was it something that you saw your parents do, or you have siblings that were adventurous and wanted to kind of push the envelope on a number of different levels?
Yeah, I've tried to question that in myself, and certainly now the sort of older you become. And I think a lot of it comes from having two boys and trying. My role is sort of injecting that adventure and excitement, I guess, and channeling that energy into their lives. And one of the things I became really aware of quite a few years ago was that you could sort of tell your kids what to do, or what you hope for them to do, or you could actually just demonstrate in your own life what you're trying to do.
How old are your boys?
12 and 9.
Okay.
Yeah, and they're unreal. They're on fire.
I'll get some parenting advice from you. Never miss an opportunity to get a bit of parenting advice. But keep going down that track. So it's instead of just telling them, you know, try this, try that, do this, do that, lead by example.
Absolutely. Yeah. So we do quite a bit of stuff together. They love their mountain bikes. I don't have a mountain bike, so we'll go to the mountain bike tracks down near our house and I'll run around them. And then they'll throw out challenges, or we'll throw out challenges to each other. Last Sunday we went for a bit of a run and got up to just under 40 Ks or so, and they're on their bikes. And we do those sorts of things. We'll get out there and just go. But for them, it was, I really wanted them to see that, hey, look, you know, there's a few things you can control in your life, and there's some that you can't. And the things that you can control are what you think about, what you focus on, and your actions principally. So they know that, you know, for 10 years I've been doing that swim since I were tiny kids, and they know that the community that is around that is such a supportive and a caring component, I guess. And, you know, for them to see that is great. And I guess it trickles down to every school holidays, or just to give you an example of what they do. So on school holidays on a Friday, our old neighbors go and do Meals on Wheels, or the lady does, Glenys, and she looks after them on that Friday, and they'll go and do Meals on Wheels with her. And they love it. That's a highlight of their school holidays. And that's not something that we've asked them to do or anything. They just went once, coincidentally, and then have loved it, and they look forward to it every Friday on a school holiday. And for me, that's a great thing to see, because they're, you know, just little kids, but seeing what a difference it makes, like delivering a hot meal to someone who's typically alone in their house, maybe with a dog or something, and their only connection with people may be, you know, a couple of visits from Bluna, you know, nursing
home or something. And what did they say when you told them about the swim, the 10 days?
When I was doing it, starting it?
Yeah. Or even when you're planning it.
Well, it was, I guess, like
crazy,
it's sort of kicking in my head for a while, and then I didn't sort of make it known until probably about a month before. So the boys were pretty keen to get some time off school and come, but they didn't manage to do that. But they did come out a couple of times, or at least see me a few times. So that was good. They just sort of went, oh, wow, okay. And then once they sort of saw the amount of effort that went into it or actually doing it, then, you know, for them, they're pretty happy. And it's been thrown back at me quite a few times. We'll do things and they're always like, come on, Dad. And I'll be like, oh, and they're going, come on, you love a challenge. Let's go.
Yeah. So, as I mentioned earlier, Brendan, I always, you know, if you anybody that sits in that chair and if they've, they've got, you know, kids that are grown up the right way, or even if they've grown up the wrong way, I suppose, I never miss an opportunity. I've got a 9-year-old, there's no manual. Can you recall what's different about the way you're raising your boys to how your dad raised you? Better or worse, good, positive, negatives, whatever. Because I love the fact, you know, what you mentioned about the Meals on Wheels thing. You know, that shows great empathy and compassion for the older people living in our community. And to do that is a really wonderful thing for a 12 and a 9-year-old.
One of the most significant events that occurred in our life when we were growing up, I'm the eldest of three boys. Dad was a guy who, you know, was raised at home, and typical of those days, you moved out basically when you got married. So he went from mum to having a wife, and as it was traditional then, you know, mums took the really traditional role of being the nurturers and food providers and everything around there. So mum had an operation on her foot and had some pins inserted and stuff. So she was out of action for about, I think it was for about 5 or 6 weeks. And in that first week, everyone brings over a meal, everyone looks after you. And then after that, you know, everyone forgets. So Dad all of a sudden turned, and he was a medical scientist. He turned from this conservative scientist guy having to still go to work and then do a bit of ironing and a bit of cooking and everything. And I guess that's when myself and my brothers had a good look as well at what was going on in the house. And we sort of realized that, hey, look, we're going to have to fend for ourselves a bit and maybe even help out a little bit more. So that made a real impact on me when I was quite young. I was probably in early teens or so. And then growing up when I was older, I guess I saw some things with some people who were maybe about 10 years older than me, similar things. So they'd go straight from a home to getting married and they'd fall into those traditional roles again. And I just thought, you know what? I've got to be this independent domesticated male because I don't want to rely on other people, particularly someone that you're going to be in a relationship with and you love, that is going to have to mother you. Was not what I was looking for.
You know what you've described is very common for like the Italian culture, which is my background with people, you know, especially boys, they stay with their mums until they're married and then they get married and then they don't know how to peel an onion or iron a shirt. Now, I know that because I've had to be independent and I moved out of home in the late 80s to follow radio, et cetera. But the weird thing about it is when my son's around, I'm still tying up his shoelaces. And so, you know, and I've got to stop that because I need him to understand that he's got to do it because he's got to be independent. But it's a hard habit to break, isn't it? Or are you a bit stricter with your boys?
No.
I had to learn. You've got to learn.
You're probably similar. And I think we all are as parents. Like, you want to create this beautiful environment and protect them from so many things.
Yeah.
But then you, on the other hand, and you've just taken your son over to Europe, so, you know, to get him exposed to other cultures and ways of living. And on the other hand, you really need to give them the small doses of fear, failure, and success. And let them experience that on their own 2 feet. But you want to do it so that you've got your hands underneath so you can catch when they fall, you know, so nothing's broken basically.
Yeah.
So I guess that's the attitude I've taken. Since I've been in nappies, I've always had them down the beach in the water and everything. But I came to a realization a lot of the work I was doing was I'd live on the coast here.
Yeah.
But I'd be away and I'd come back on a Wednesday night, Friday night. And even then, I'd come back late on a Wednesday night enough to, they would have had dinner and I'd be putting them in bed, maybe reading a story. And then I'd be up and gone at, you know, 4:35 in the morning.
Yeah.
And after quite a few years of that, I think this is only like 3 or 4 years ago, I realized that, hey, look, the type of life I'm trying to get my boys to live, I'm just not doing it. So it was lead by example again. So, you know, we made some significant changes there and, you know, we're here on the coast every day, pretty much every day. So life's a bit different.
Yeah.
So, but I think that's a really important thing. And the thing that frustrates a lot of people is that, that whole, And it's not just mums, it's dads as well, but that helicopter mum sort of term where you're hovering over the kids. They don't get to free range too much, or things are a bit controlled or restrictive. And it's not, the world's not that scary place. Like, you can work out, you know, little things for them to do that. And sport's a great way of doing that. Basically jumping in and trying anything, whether it be musical minded or, you know, creating a video and putting it up on your own YouTube channel, whatever it is you're going to do with your kids and encourage them. But we do lots of little things. And I guess getting back to the domesticated side of things, one of the challenges I have with the boys is that they have to create their own signature dishes. And essentially—
Does a nine-year-old do that?
Yeah. Really? Look, we describe him as being quite beige with his food. He's getting better, but but the one who's 12, from when he was in nappies, I remember him, you know, trying to eat my vindaloo curry and everything. So he's all over his food, and he's, one of his signature dishes is his spicy guacamole. So
really?
He does that all, you know, from scratch. And
what about the nine-year-old? What's his signature dish?
Well, other than two-minute noodles, no, he's he does a few things, but not they're not as varied. He loves a good steak, and knows medium rare is the way he has it, and well salted and everything.
You mentioned your dad was a medical scientist.
Yes.
Where was that? Whereabouts in Australia?
Well, I can take it even back further if you like. My earliest childhood memories are Papua New Guinea.
Oh, really?
So. When I was really tiny, 2 years old, two and a half, three, we went over there for a couple of years. So Dad was a scientist back then, and there was some Commonwealth agency that he was working for that we ended up over there.
Yeah,
and some of their life's strongest lifelong friends are doctors and people that they worked with.
They met at PNG.
Yeah.
I've actually got a friend as well who for very similar reasons, spent a fair bit of time in PNG, and so much so that he went back recently to work there.
Oh, really?
Do you feel that connection as well, that in terms of, you know, these early childhood memories and a connection to PNG?
Not really, other than that I meet a lot of people who also spent their childhood in PNG Yeah, but it's a very different country now. We were up in the highlands as well, and some of the areas we were in, we were the only white babies that they had seen. My younger brother was born in Goroka, I think, up in the highlands there, and I used to get abducted by our little houseboy. I shouldn't say little houseboy, but, you know, I think Dad's lab assistant used to take me up to the village, and Mum would freak out because she's got a little baby, and all of a sudden, you know, the 2.5, 3-year-old son's missing, and he'd just take me up into the village because they never see white kids. So back then, you know, we're talking early 70s.
Yeah.
So
a scary place, or not so scary?
No, well, not for me. I do still remember these guys, the mud men, and they'd wear these big mud masks and everything. Nice. And at Sing Sing's, the big festivals, they would just freak me out. So there's a few things there. Other listeners might know Kokomo, that bird that swoops you a bit like a magpie, but prettier. Yeah.
Okay.
So those early childhood memories, I remember those things. But I also remember sitting up in the village and them playing ukulele and just singing and just sitting around, and the women would be weaving baskets and everything, and everyone would be playing with you and that. And so it was.
And when you came back to Australia, where did you settle?
Brisbane.
Okay.
Yeah, so we were in Bris Vegas, and my mum had moved around a lot when she was growing up, and she was quite adamant that, you know, when we came back to Brisbane, that's it, we were going to stay in the one spot. So that's what we did. So we stayed in that one area or that one house in Brisbane for many years, and I did primary school and high school while I was there. Yeah.
You mentioned earlier that you are someone that likes to push themselves and push the envelope and challenge, you know, yourself physically and mentally. Any other plans, Brendan?
Yeah, look, I guess I'm experiencing a lot of new things in life at the moment. I'm recently become separated, so it's an interesting little journey, being the shared custody of two boys and being a father there. And I guess there's a lot of challenges that come with that. But on the flip side, there's a great deal of choice and new beginnings you get out of that. And one of the things that I'm really enjoying with the boys is that we're sitting down and structuring what the best life would be for basically three blokes living in one house. So we're going through all the things that you know, we
does
love
it
that
Xbox
are important
and PlayStation 4 and that kind
no,
of stuff.
No, well, this is really funny. I have never had those challenges with the boys. They're pretty much free range on electronic devices. So, you know, they both had iPads for years and everything.
You don't put a time limit on their usage?
No, I've never had to. They're self-regulated. And it frustrates them that friends will sit on like Fortnite or something and play that for hours and hours and hours. They don't even play it. They are into other things electronic, and I encourage it. I think it's great. They have their favorite YouTube personalities that they follow. They're really keen to get a YouTube channel started. We're still trying to, you know, devise the most appropriate way we can put that together.
So what idea or plans did you come up with for this house where four guys are living in?
Three. Myself and the two guys. Yeah. So, yeah, look, the most important thing, so we've realized that food and entertaining is a really big thing for us. So even though the boys and I guess have sort of been living our own lives for some time. We were all in one house together with their mum for a period of time. And whenever we cook dinner, it's a bit of a – it's part of a process we go through. So, we set the table really nicely if we're sitting inside or outside. Yeah. You have candles lit. You do the dinner nicely. You present it nicely. You go and pick flowers from the garden. You include that in there. And I've always included the boys in preparing that together and helping in some way and thinking about what we're doing ahead. And we do that and make it – and I guess – I'm not Italian, but I'd love to tap into, you know, that long lunch feel. And it's a similar thing. Like when we cook like that, I'll have a glass of wine or champagne and, you know, we'll put a lot of, not so much effort, but it's a lot of joy into that. And if whoever we're inviting.
It's a significant part of the day, I think, in a number of cultures where the family gets to come together and talk. Yeah. Which is equally as important as the food and share those experiences.
Absolutely.
And,
And it's good for guests as well. And if you can have things mostly prepped and then you're finishing off stuff, it's a good way of interacting and seeing how people, what they enjoy as you're preparing it and everything. But so that's a big aspect of how our life is going to be in the future.
Can I share this line with you guys?
Yeah, please.
I listened to a podcast yesterday. And John Cleese was on Mark Maron's podcast. And they ended the podcast with this. John Cleese said, I find the less you need, the happier you are.
Mm.
And I've really thought about that for the last 24 hours. I thought, you know, and he was just talking about, you know, good company, his wife, a book.
Yep.
You know, good chair to read the book in. And you know, it just kind of connected and resonated with me. What do you think of that? You know, the less you need, the happier your life is.
I think it's really important. And someone I could attribute it to a few people, I don't know who, but they said, you know, the more things you have, the more they have you.
Yeah, that's a good one too. I like that.
I have, John, I don't have many regrets in life, but I do have one. And I went through a bit of a Buddhist non-attachment phase many years ago. And
what's that mean?
Oh, just not hanging on to lots of material things and just cleansing the house or, you know, getting rid of stuff was a big thing. And I mistakenly got rid of something that I really regret now. Years ago when I was living in Japan, I had a Canadian friend that I worked with and he was from what we'd say the country part of Canada, his Calgary guy. And he bought back some really cool snakeskin boots for me. And they were so cool. They were rattlesnake skin boots. Come back to Australia, you know, and they sit in the cupboard for years and you never wear them unless it's a fancy dress. And, you know, I got rid of them. And I have to say that's one of the big regrets I have in life.
Yeah.
I don't have the
and I can relate to that. I had like
boots.
I did, not that I ever owned a motorcycle, but like this leather motorcycle jacket that I had when I lived and worked in Melbourne because it was cold.
Mm.
And same deal, sat in the cupboard for ages, and I got rid of it. And then thought, but that's about nostalgia. You know, I think that's about you don't have them in the cupboard because you're going to wear them. You have them because every time you look at it, it reminds you of a certain period of life.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what those things are about.
Oh,
but would you do that again, like that you know, cleansing yourself of materialistic things? Was that, in hindsight, apart from the boots, was that good for you? Did you like?
Completely.
Yeah.
You realize, I can't remember the name, there is a Japanese lady who specializes in the philosophy around detachment from physical possessions. And I think one of the underlying cause of that philosophy is that everything you own takes up a little part of your brain. So you know that you've got, you know, ladies will know they've got some certain boots that are sitting in the back corner of the cupboard that they'll only drag out when they go to Melbourne or something, or that we've all got some funny little thing sitting in the garage or something somewhere. And I think, if you can get rid of those things that are cluttering up your head. It certainly is a good experience. And I sort of like it as well because you sort of lose a bit of materialism as well, I think. And I don't really see the value in a lot of things just to show off either.
Do you still live like that now?
Yes, yeah. And I think that's, you know, certainly setting up your own household and everything, if you're starting from scratch or something, is a really good way of, you know, kicking off again and thinking of, okay, what is important? What do I need? And at the moment, you know, our fridge is full of yellow post-it notes and they're all the little things I've got to buy that I don't have. Yeah. And you go to cook or do something, you go, oh, damn, where is this thing? Yeah. And yeah, so it's just all these funny little things that you just don't even think of. So boys and I having a good time with those things as well.
Yeah. All right, Brendan, I really appreciate you coming in and sharing some of your story with us. I think it's great.
Yeah. Hey, look, I've listened to a lot of your conversations in Noosa.
Thank you.
Yeah, I love them. It's good. We've got a lot of interesting characters here on the coast, and I'm glad that people like yourself are getting their stories out and sharing it.
Brendan Neal was my guest today. I hope you enjoyed that. If you did, rate and review the podcast on whatever platform you listen to it on. Maybe it was iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, Wooshka, Stitcher. We'll be back again next week. Another podcast for you. Remember to keep coming back to the In Noosa Magazine website, innoosamagazine.com.au/conversations, or simply subscribe on those podcast platforms that I mentioned. Until next time, take care.